BBC.
BBC.
You're with the BBC. Hello, I'm Harriet Gilbert. Welcome to the World Book Club, where this month we've been reading the prize-winning novel The Reluctant Fundamentalist, and here to answer questions about it from an invited audience and from BBC listeners around the world is its author, the Pakistani Mohsin Hamid. Mohsin, welcome to the World Book Club.
Thank you.
You've lived in Pakistan, you've lived in the USA, you've lived in the UK. Where are you based now?
I'm based in London. I wander a fair bit, so I was in Pakistan until about 2 weeks ago, and I'm off to the States for a week or so in Feb, but my home is in London.
The Reluctant Fundamentalist is your second novel, and unlike many second novels, which are rather a disappointment, this one absolutely isn't. I mean, it sort of almost has outshone Moth Smoke, your first one. You know, it's got prizes and praise all over the place. And I just wondered to what extent you think that is, because instead of rushing it out on the back of Moth Smoke, you took 7 years writing it.
I don't know. I mean, it's hard to look at being stuck for several years as a productive thing. And Moth Smoke actually took 7 years to write as well. So I don't know if the length of time made much difference. My editor in the U.S., Becky Salatan, tells me that her writers always seem to write in a particular way, and they fool themselves into thinking they can do it differently, but they can't. So it may just be that I'm a seven-year novelist, and I try writing my novels many different ways and many different times, and the process was remarkably similar both times out.
Well, we actually have two questions which I'm going to ask now, which came one from a Pakistani listener to the BBC World Service, Farooq Malik, and another from Sarah Ali, who's in Hertfordshire in the UK. And I think I'll ask it in Farooq Malik's words. I mean, he says, I'm looking forward to your next novel, one which hopefully won't take as long to write. But so are they both going to be disappointed?
I don't know. Reluctant Fundamentalist came out almost 2 years ago. And the last writing on it was done 2.5 years ago. And as of today, when I looked at my laptop yesterday, I had nothing that I thought I would likely keep of a third novel, which means it's not that I haven't written anything, but I haven't written anything useful. So they may be disappointed, unfortunately.
Well, the 7 years' wait is worth it. Published in 2007, The Reluctant Fundamentalist won literary awards from around the world and has been translated into 22 languages. It's slim for a novel, less than 200 pages, and it's essentially a monologue spoken by a young Pakistani called Changez as he sits in a tea shop in Lahore telling the story of his life. He is, in fact, addressing another character, an American whose name we never learn and whose reactions we can only deduce from Changez's occasional remarks. Don't be alarmed, sir, for instance, or you seem worried. For the most part, though, Changez talks about himself, his success as a student at Princeton University in the USA, his winning of a prestigious, well-paid job at a valuation company, his love for an ultimately unobtainable American woman called Erica, his reaction to the terror attacks at the 11th of September 2001, his leaving of his job, and his return to Pakistan. As Changez talks, the evening darkens, bats come out to swoop through the air, and the edginess between the two men, the jangle of menace and possible violence, grows ever more unsettling. But which of them is a danger to which, if either? Well, Mohsin Hamid, I wonder if you'd start by reading from the very beginning of The Reluctant Fundamentalist.
Excuse me, sir, but may I be of assistance? Ah, I see I have alarmed you. Do not be frightened by my beard. I am a lover of America. I noticed that you were looking for something. More than looking, in fact, you seem to be on a mission. And since I am both a native of this city and a speaker of your language, I thought I might offer you my services. How did I know you were American? No, not by the color of your skin. We have a range of complexions in this country, and yours occurs often among the people of our northwest frontier. Nor was it your dress that gave you away. A European tourist could as easily have purchased in Des Moines your suit with its single vent and your button-down shirt. True, your hair, short-cropped, and your expansive chest, the chest, I would say, of a man who bench-presses regularly and maxes out well above 225, are typical of a certain type of American. But then again, sportsmen and soldiers of all nationalities tend to look alike. Instead, it was your bearing that allowed me to identify you, and I do not mean that as an insult, for I see your face is hardened, but merely as an observation.
Mohsin Hamid, thank you very much. And now a question about the reluctant fundamentalist from the World Book Club here at Bush House. Yes, the gentleman at the back there.
Yes, Michael O'Connor from Romford. I'd like to ask you why you chose to write this book in a monologue style.
I tried to not write the book in a monologue style many times, and it didn't really work. So I wrote the novel in a first-person, sort of American-accented, 22-year-old voice. I wrote it in a third-person voice, and something just was bottled up. And eventually, I stumbled across the monologue as a way of doing it, because the monologue opens up a sort of a space to, I guess, play as a writer. A dramatic monologue is a bit like a play. It's like a one-man play where you're sitting in the audience and a character standing on a stage speaking to somebody else, perhaps on stage, that you can't see. And it does two things. It reminds you, the reader, that this isn't real. There's something here which isn't quite real, and it asks you to accept that it isn't real. And secondly, it forces you to step into the novel a little bit and provide the missing half of what is a conversation, but as you say, is shown as a monologue. And when you step in to provide the missing half, the reader gives meaning to the book. And I wrote the novel intentionally with blank spaces that the reader gets to fill in. So is it a frightening novel? Is it a love story? Is it, you know, a thriller? A lot of that depends on how the reader reads the other character in the novel. And in that sense, what the dramatic monologue lets me do, which is, I think, one of the main ambitions of the novel, is to show the reader a bit of a mirror that says, a lot of this novel isn't really there. You're making it up as you go along. What are you making up and why? So if you're frightened, you know, what's frightening you, and what does it mean that you're so easily frightened?
The voice you do choose for Changez is far from American. It is quite a stately, formal, upper-class English voice. How did you get to that?
I play a lot with voice as a writer, and in my first novel, Mordsmoke, there are many different voices. This one, as I said before, I did try writing in sort of an American-accented 22-year-old voice. It didn't really work. The voice that I chose is, as you say, it sounds a bit like an upper-class English accent, except for the fact that nobody here would probably speak like this. It's something of a caricature of an upper-class English accent. It's the legacy of a school system where there are still fee-paying schools in places like Pakistan that teach people to speak in a way that is anachronistic and that symbolizes a kind of class but is actually Victorian in its time frame as opposed to contemporary. But I think the voice does other things as well, because it sounds like it's from the past and because it has this degree of formality and courtliness, it distances the listener or the reader. And in the present day, when someone is speaking to you so formally, distancing you in that way, it can be off-putting or frightening or even threatening to be spoken to with that kind of formality. So this voice, for me, it felt a lot like I would imagine many people in countries like Britain or America would think of Islam as something from a previous time, overly formal and frightening in its sort of courtly formalness.
Another question from Mohsin Hamid.
Hello, I was wondering how you researched the book, and I'm particularly interested in research you might have done with Muslim Americans and the evolution they might have and their love affair they may have with the American dream.
I was going to say I didn't research the book, and that's not true. I think I researched the book simply by living my life. What I do as a writer tends to be two things. I try to write about things with which I'm at least somewhat familiar. So I went to Princeton. I've worked in a corporate firm in New York City. So I've seen those worlds. And then I try to write about what is unfamiliar to me, so particular characters, by imagining being someone like that. And for me, writing a woman character, the voice of a woman character, is a bit like dressing up in drag. It's not that I can honestly say I've become a woman, but I try to imagine what it would be like to be a woman and speak like a woman and think like a woman, and not just a woman, but this particular woman. And so, in a way, it feels almost more like acting.
Well, Mohsin Hamid, we've got a question for you now, which comes from Sandra Gillette, and she's on the telephone now to ask it of you. Sandra, hi.
Hi, this is Sandra Gillette, and I'm calling from Princeton, New Jersey. I'm the scribe of a very active book group at Princeton. And by the way, before I ask my question, I'd like to say, Mr. Hamid, on behalf of my book group, that we would love to have you join us for dinner if you ever find yourself in the Princeton area.
Thank you very much. That's a wonderful offer.
Well, I hope you'll take us up on it. The question I have is that the fundamentalism in the story develops along non-religious lines, racism and the just the facts analytical business assessments. And I wondered whether this was a deliberate effort to show that fundamentalism can have its birth in non-religious roots.
I'm glad you asked that question, because there are different aspects of what religion is. There are spiritual questions in religion. You know, where do I come from? What am I doing here? How do I make peace with the notion that I will die one day? And then there are other questions related to identity, you know, which we call religion. And in this novel, the spirituality of Islam is not a primary concern for Cengiz. The notion of being a Muslim, of being part of a group of people, is part of Cengiz and part of this novel. And I wanted to separate the two things. So I guess that's how I approached it. And on fundamentalism, you're right, because in the novel, Cengiz is a reluctant fundamentalist, but he's not particularly religious. And so, therefore, his fundamentalism isn't a religious fundamentalism. And the fundamentalism that he reacts most strongly against is the notion of valuing companies on the basis of their economic fundamentals without regard to the human consequences for the people being so valued. And that's what he begins to rebel against. So without trying to draw a overly simplistic thing of saying, you know, religious fundamentalism, capitalist fundamentalism equals the same thing, what I am trying to suggest is that any value system that begins from some a priori assumption of what I believe to be true must be right can be dangerous. And the novel plays with a couple different versions of that.
Sandra Gillette, thank you very much indeed for that. And now a question from the audience here at Bush House. Yes, the gentleman there.
Thank you. Now, this is a wonderful, wonderful love story. Erica is attracted to Cengiz in the first place by his striking generosity and courtesy. Indeed, it's the salient quality that stands out for her. Now, would you agree that one of the big themes in this novel is what J.G. Ballard called the death of affection in Western culture?
Mm-hmm.
That we no longer care for courtesy, manners.
I don't know if I believe there's been a death of affection. What I do find is when I go to Pakistan, and I hate to generalize about these things because, you know, you're talking about billions of people and my little walk through the world is not representative of billions of people. But when I go to Pakistan, the one thing which I really most value about going home to Pakistan is the amount of affection which I access very easily through family, friends, you know, people I haven't seen in a very long time. And I definitely do feel in my life in London, in my home in London, that while there are many things that I love about my life here, the quantity of affection available to me seems very much less. Now, that's partly where I was born, where I grew up, where one has roots and where one has relationships. But underneath it all, I think there is something whereby when we begin to commoditize ourselves and when we begin to build a world that is about transactions and about money and about competition and about success, etc., etc., we can construct environments that are less susceptible to human affection. And in an economically rather dysfunctional place like Pakistan, I think there's less of that commoditization of people going on. I'd hate to say that the lack of economic prosperity is the price we have to pay to have affection in our lives. But there's something there. There's some sort of link. And as far as Erica and Cengiz, the way that their affection plays out and the way that the love story plays out, I think that Erica likes the kind of affection which Cengiz offers her, which appears to be an unintrusive affection, allowing her to sort of be...
Well, the space she talks about...
That is not something which, in my experience, is a particularly Pakistani characteristic. I don't find that in Pakistan I'm afforded all that much space.
Another question from Mohsin Hamid, from the lady in the second row.
Hello, Mary de Laszlo. At the beginning, you were talking about the reader took what they wanted from your book, which I think is very, very true. And I read in one of your reviews that somebody had got quite carried away and thought that Erica was America, and that the story of Shanez's sad love story, which never really came to much because she was so dysfunctional, was sort of an anagram of America that never quite comes. You think it's a wonderful dream, but it isn't really. It's false underneath. And I wondered how true that was, or was it just somebody writing that in, seeing that in?
Well, you know, it's interesting because the name Erica is the second half of America. As a novelist, I'm not very fond of generalizing in the sense of saying, you know, here's 300 million diverse people, America. Let me now summarize them with one quick sweep of the pen. Or I try to avoid doing that sort of thing. But in the way that I write a novel, I try to create, I guess, interpretive potential is the best way I can talk about it. In other words, you're going down the motorway, highway of a novel, and the story is unfolding for you. And all along the route, there are exit signs and exit ramps for you to go off and do your own thing. And where you go when you go off the ramp and into the stuff which isn't written on the page is sort of up to you. But certainly the name Erica is an invitation to take a particular exit ramp. For me, I haven't overly inscribed that name with a direct, you know, she is America, but rather created sort of certain eddies and echoes which are hopefully interesting to explore. So that means that there is something to the interpretation that you mentioned, but that something is not the same as saying that is what I intended, really.
No, I think somebody else thought that's what it was. And also I felt that perhaps Shanez's anger was, a lot of his anger was stemming from his anger of being let down by the American dream.
I think that, you know, the love story is very much a story of spurned love. And I tend to think that hatred and love are related emotions, not necessarily sequential. You don't have to go from love to hatred or hatred to love. But there's something in both of those concepts, love and hatred, which is similar. And that is the degree of connection to the subject, you know, to the object of your feeling. In other words, if you hate someone, there's a powerful bond between you. And if you love someone, there is too. And so that notion that love, affection, desire can quickly give way to the opposite is embedded there. And I think in Chinggis's case, it really is the story of someone who is both very much in love with his experience of his life in America and with Erica living there, and also very angry about it. And it's hard to separate the two things.
Thank you.
Mohsin Hamid, I think now would be a very good moment for a reading from the heart of the book. It's the point at which Chinggis actually understands how his emotional relationship with the USA has changed. It's a passage, he's thinking back to September 2001. He's been sent to the Philippines for work.
The following evening was supposed to be our last in Manila. I was in my room, packing my things. I turned on the television and saw what at first I took to be a film. But as I continued to watch, I realized that it was not fiction, but news. I stared as one, and then the other, of the twin towers of New York's World Trade Center collapsed. And then I smiled. Yes, despicable as it may sound, my initial reaction was to be remarkably pleased. Your disgust is evident. Indeed, your large hand has, perhaps without your noticing, clenched into a fist. But please believe me when I tell you that I am no sociopath. I am not indifferent to the suffering of others. When I hear of an acquaintance who has been diagnosed with a serious illness, I feel, almost without fail, a sympathetic pain, a twinge in my kidneys strong enough to elicit a wince. When I'm approached for a donation to charity, I tend to be forthcoming, at least insofar as my modest means will permit. So when I tell you I was pleased at the slaughter of thousands of innocents, I do so with a profound sense of perplexity.
Mohsin Hamid, thank you very much. And now a question about the reluctant fundamentalist from the audience here at Bush House, at the very back there in the turquoise.
as Ingrid Skinner. The book addresses the issue of why someone with so many privileges and a seemingly good life in the US could possibly have sympathy with people who are inflicting violence on the country. And I know that that's something that many Americans in particular with struggled after 9/11. So how has your book been received in the US?
It's hard to generalize, but I think quite generously, for the most part. I remember going to Dallas, Texas, on my book tour. And I was sort of, you know, unshaven, had a stubbly kind of beard, and being this sort of stubbly bearded Pakistani writer in Dallas, Texas, felt to me a little bit like being a clean-shaven American Marine in the northwest frontier province of Pakistan. I thought I was, you know, in hostile territory. And the local paper, I think it was called the Dallas Star or something like that, wrote a review of the book just before I got there, saying that you may not like what this character has to say, but you will find yourself half sympathizing with him as he says it. And I think that notion of, you know, let's explore these directions without saying morally that what Chinggis wants is or isn't necessarily right, but let's explore what somebody like Chinggis might feel, because there's an act of empathy in doing that, and that act of empathy allows us to understand other people a bit better. So I think that response was quite common in America, and so, you know, the book was overall quite well received, and I was very pleased. I mean, one thing I will say about that was, as I was writing the book, you know, we all know of novels that have elicited all sorts of anger towards their authors, you know, whether it's Lolita for Nabokov about pedophilia, or more recent novels, for example, that arouse the ire of the Ayatollah Khomeini or whatever. For me, when I wrote about September 11th, which I thought was a very sensitive thing and has had in some ways acquired the sense of being an almost sacred text, you know, it had become a thing about which blasphemy was not encouraged. I thought, you know, how do I write about this? And what I tried to do is I tried to write in a way that would be honest to Chinggis's experience, but at the same time, without sort of mocking or belittling the suffering of those involved or those who felt very strongly about it. And in a way, that is, it's a choice to try not to mock other points of view, and to respect the existence of other points of view while quite firmly saying things that may speak to a different truth. And I don't think that's a requirement for a novelist. I think novelists should be free to offend whomever they choose. But in my own case, growing up in Pakistan, you know, in the 80s, when General Zia-ul Haq was our dictator and this huge process of Islamization, in quotes, was underway, there were real consequences to saying things. And so I don't act as though I live in a bubble where there are no consequences to my words. I think there are consequences. And I take those consequences seriously, and I try to express myself in ways that avoids inviting unintended consequences. In other words, I don't want to be in the business of trying to humiliate people or anger people for the sake of humiliating them or angering them, but rather to try to express what's on my mind in a way that doesn't necessarily invite anger or humiliation, but doesn't at the same time, I guess, censor itself to avoid those things.
Can I ask you, Sandra Gillette, if you're still there on the telephone, as an American reading The Reluctant Fundamentalist, what did you feel when you read that passage we've heard, the moment when Chinggis feels pleasure at what he sees happening as the Twin Towers are hit?
Well, actually, we discussed this in the book group last night when we met for our regular meeting, and we were reviewing this. And we found the whole book story very compelling, and the writing itself and the story construction absolutely superb. But all that being said, 9/11 is, even though it was 8 years ago, is still a very raw wound here, and particularly I would think on the East Coast of America. And when we reached that part of the conversation where Chinggis said, "I smiled," my initial reaction was to be remarkably pleased. It really brought you to a full stop as you were reading the book. It was disturbing and it was very discouraging. And we all felt we had lost all sympathy with Chinggis at that point. And I know for myself, I read the remainder of the novel very cautiously. I think that many people reading this novel in the United States would have the same reaction of just being brought up short at that point. But I also think that's where you have to remember that this is a novel, and this is where, again, the excellent writing and the story keep drawing you on through it.
Well, thank you very much for that, Sandra. And now, Mohsin Hamid, an email for you. It comes from Sonal Shah, who lives in London, and writes this. Mohsin, given the extremely industrious, motivated and ambitious main character, I was immensely surprised by his giving up everything for what seemed to be non-concrete or well-defined reasons. Is there a specific psychology you were trying to draw out? I just couldn't get into Changez's head and understand him, whilst up to that point I could fully follow his motivations. Perhaps this is realism portrayed on a profound level that we may never truly understand ourselves, let alone others?
Well, the thing to keep in mind is how young Changez is. So in the novel, Changez is a 22-year-old young man. I find myself almost wanting to say boy, but he's a young man. He's 22 years old. I'm 37, so...
So much older.
So I'm significantly older, but I remember being 22 quite well. And I think the industrious Changez, etc., gives way to something else which you see all over the world. It's the desire of young men who are about 22 to slay dragons. You know, that romantic quest, which is very difficult to explain reasonably or rationally, we've seen people doing it from the beginning of time. And whether they do that by joining a sports team, signing up to serve in their nation's army, strapping on explosives and blowing themselves up in the middle of a group of you know, innocent families around them, or as Changez does, dropping out of sort of this corporate system and going back to Pakistan and agitating in his own way, that's a very real thing. And I think to begin to imagine what romantic quest people think they are on is helpful as we consider lots of, violent young 20-something-year-old men or threatening young 20-something-year-old men and how their objectives don't seem to make all that much sense in light of where they've been. So I think Changez makes a bit of a leap. You know, he is looking for a kind of romantic quest for himself. And he looks for it romantically, emotionally, romantically with Erica. He looks at it in his work in America, and he looks at it in other directions as well. And the other thing I would say about it is when we look at actions that we believe to be evil, done by people we have no reason to think are more evil than others, it is interesting to wonder why. And I would think in the why often lies, some desperate attempt for a kind of human greatness, which modern society in the modern world provides relatively few avenues to pursue.
Thank you. I have a question for you now, which comes from an Iraqi listener to the BBC who lives in Canada. She's Suad Sharabani. And she asks this. I wonder whether any place on this planet would have been satisfying for Changez, or would he always be searching for that ideal condition, be it in the USA or in Pakistan? Is that where the similarities between Changez and Erica can be drawn, that there was nowhere for either of them to be complete?
I think so. I mean, one thing that both Changez and Erica suffer from is a modern disease that I refer to as nostalgia. And nostalgia, I think, is a powerful illness of our time. In its basic form, it is the longing of someone for the past.
And we should say that Erica's, why in fact the relationship never works between her and Changez is because she is still in love with her first love, a young man called Chris who died of cancer, and she can't forget him.
That's right. So Erica remains in love with her childhood boyfriend, who is now dead. And Changez perhaps remains in love with her, but certainly remains in love with a Pakistan that he no longer lives in, or a notion of Pakistan that he no longer occupies. And this nostalgia is quite dangerous in both cases. One thing which is worth saying is that it's also how we view it. So Erica, now a woman in love with a dead ex-boyfriend who is now under medication and seems to be wasting away, we call clinically depressed or mentally ill. But, if she's Juliet, as in Romeo and Juliet, or if she's any of hundreds of heroines in the pantheon of of great lovers that have existed in all of our cultures going back to, you know, the beginning of history. That would have been, you know, the ideal model of love, that you love once. When you love fully. And when love is over, life is over. It's sort of a change in our perspective, which makes her so broken, I guess, in a way. Now, both of these characters have this nostalgia, Erica for this love which can no longer exist, and Genghis for his past. And I think at a bigger level, nostalgia is a very dangerous force, because although everybody, well, not everybody, many of us feel we look at the past nostalgically, because in the past, you know, we were younger, we and those we knew were further away from death. And so therefore, you know, our friends were still around, our parents were still around, we were young and free and whatever. So it's a basic human thing to have a sense of nostalgia. But when the world starts changing very quickly, more and more quickly, as I think it's doing now, the speed of change is intensifying and accelerating, then the future starts to look more frightening and nostalgia becomes all the more seductive. And so then you have political cries for nostalgia, whether it's, you know, George W. Bush talking to America in a militaristic, you know, way that harkens back to the Second World War and the old certainties that came with that time, or Osama bin Laden speaking, you know, ostensibly to Muslims about an imagined version of the great caliphates and the high point of Islam, or European politicians talking about, you know, their societies at some post-Second World War moment when they were still racially homogenous but able to afford a welfare state. Any one of those sorts of claims is a nostalgic claim. And it's dangerous because nostalgic claims don't actually equip us for the future. They just create an emotional response to futures we can't control. And in that sense, these two are suffering from that. And it's possible that nostalgia is in the nature of who Genghis and Erica are. And if so, then what your questioner asked, our questioner asked, that maybe they couldn't be happy anywhere, is possibly true.
Yes, here.
Hello. Just like to say how much I enjoyed the book, and I read it a second time, and it was sort of more interesting and complex. And our book group was very interested in the word reluctant, and my question was about the fact that you seem to single out particular incidences, like critical incidences, really, in Chagre's journey. And I can remember one particularly at the end when he went to Chile and met Juan Batista,
yeah.
Thank you very much. Sorry about that. Who said he added considerable momentum to my journey. So you got the sense that he was on a journey. Did he not want to go down there? Was the reluctant about the fact that he met these people and they had a big impact on him? So when he talked to that man in Chile, he thought, actually, I've got to go back.
Well,
why reluctant?
Well, reluctant in the novel, there's a few reasons for reluctant in the novel. In that moment that you talk about, Juan Bautista, that name is there for a number of different reasons. And this goes back to our Erica conversation earlier. Somebody asked, you know, is Erica America? Well, Juan Bautista is John the Baptist. And so to a certain extent, that it opens up a kind of change in the life of Genghis. Bautista is also quite similar to the name of Batista, who's a figure in Latin American history, in Cuba in particular, and in events that gave rise to Fidel Castro. And Jean-Baptiste is the narrator of The Fall by Camus, which is a similar confessional narrative, which I felt the need to tip sort of an artistic hat to for inspiration. And so all of these different things are going on. You know, there's sort of stylistic, political, whatever, spiritual, or at least emotional journeys that Genghis is on and that come to a kind of nexus at the point in the novel that you referred to. And reluctant, well, he is reluctant, at least in that moment, he is reluctant because he is someone who regards their journey as a journey they go on despite a desire to go in a different direction. Now, it could be argued that actually his desire was to go in this direction all along, and he's just cast the story of his life as a, you know, how could it be that I wound up here when I wanted something quite different? Actually, it may be I wanted this all along and was trying to pretend I wanted something different. So whether he's really reluctant or not is open to question. But in the novel itself, the notion of reluctant is, you know, the reluctant fundamentalist is not really about a man who is a religious fundamentalist in the way the term is normally understood. So there's the reluctance he feels of being seen as a fundamentalist, the same way anyone who looks like they come from Pakistan or the Middle East, has a beard, you know, walks in those days of around 2001, 2002, one felt that there was an assumption of fundamentalism until your girlfriend showed up in her miniskirt and you ordered a beer. And so there was something to be disproved. There was a reluctance to be characterized as a fundamentalist. And then, of course, there's the journey that he seems to be resisting, which is to go back to Pakistan and become what he becomes. And it's a reluctant journey in that sense. And then I think I said before, the notion that his work and this economic activity of valuing companies on their fundamentals and then buying and selling those companies was a task that he was reluctant to continue to perform because of its very visible impact on people that he had a degree of affinity towards. Does that...
Yes, absolutely. But I was just thinking, because the other bit that I got with these critical incidences was the impact it had on him. So the impact of 9/11, the impact when he was calling effing Arab in the parking lot.
Yes.
Or, you know, sometimes he seemed to be sort of whacked on the head and that's how he had to go, you know.
Well, it's partly how do we construct a story, you know. Does it rain because we're sad, or is it that we notice it's raining today because we're sad and therefore we notice that one thing? And I don't know the answer to that. I think, you know, we do construct metaphors to fit the way we are telling the story of our lives to ourselves. There are other moments of impact in his life, which if he had chosen could have been the pivots, getting the job, meeting the girl, you know, his parents saying not to come home. But he chooses not to make those pivots the pivots of his life. So I think to a certain extent, we do determine our own metaphors. I mean, not that we have complete control over our lives, but when we tell the story of our lives, we, I think, can oftentimes view the world in ways that reinforces the story we want to tell.
Well, Mohsin Hamid, we've got another question for you now, which is from Edmund Punch. He's an Irish listener to the BBC who lives in Freiburg in Germany, and he's on the telephone now to ask it.
Good evening. The reluctant fundamentalist starts in the late afternoon and finishes late in the evening of the same day. Now, I started reading the book late in the afternoon and I finished in the evening of the same day in one sitting. Now, when I realized this was happening, I was totally drawn into the book because it was happening in real time. Was it your intention to pace the book like this?
Thank you for your question. It was my intention to have a reading of the book and the book happen in something that felt close to real time. So I didn't attempt to pace it so precisely as to say everything is happening and we can actually, you know, clock it. But the reason why I didn't pace it that precisely was because the assumption in the book is that there's somebody else there who is sometimes speaking and doing things and we're eliding over those gaps. So I guess for me, the reading of the book from cover to cover, if you actually don't stop and just read it through, is probably happening just a tad faster than real time unfolds. But your point is absolutely well taken. I wanted the book to feel like the experience of reading it and the experience of having lived those moments were about the same. And the reason why I liked that notion was we can spend a lot of time with books and we can spend, you know, all summer reading War and Peace or Brothers Karamazov or whatever. It's quite nice to have a reading experience where, by contrast, actually everything happens as you're reading. And in that sense, films can sometimes do that or come closer to doing that. Novels don't do it as often. But what I think it allows to happen is it makes the reading of the novel something that hopefully doesn't turn away people who find the notion of literary fiction off-putting or uninviting. And in Pakistan, most of the people I grew up with didn't really read literary fiction. And I wanted to write a novel which, without compromising on complexity, would invite people like that to come in and have the experience of a novel. And so in a way, it's a bit more like a play. You can sit down and two or three acts happen. And, you know, in the course of an afternoon and an evening, you know, you've passed through and you're done, hopefully before you can realize, you know, I don't like novels and I find novels boring. So you know, there's a combination of, I think, the aesthetic pleasure for me of something that unfolds in close to real time, as you've said, and as well as the attempt of creating a work that is open to people who otherwise might not choose to approach it.
Edmund, in your initial email to the BBC World Book Club, you had a suggestion from Mohsin Hamid's publishers, if I'm right.
Oh, yes. Well, that was, would you consider going around the bookshops and putting a sticker on the covers of the book saying, please read in one sitting starting at 4 p.m.?
You know, that's actually quite a brilliant idea. I would like to do that. You know, it's funny because I think that novel writing and storytelling are very, very closely linked. And I know Ireland, of course, is famous for its storytellers, and I have a couple of Irish friends who are great storytellers themselves. Pakistan, and certainly the Pakistanis in my family, uncles and aunts and cousins, can all spin a good yarn. And I think there's something about the storytelling form where you're sitting around a fire or a dinner table or a drink or on a rooftop, you know, watching the sunset, whatever it is that you're doing, where, you know, telling a good story can play itself out. And I think when you view a novel as almost like an oral storytelling, it means that, you know, you only have so much time before somebody has to go to sleep or go somewhere else. And that creates a kind of restriction or encouragement to be brief.
Edmund, thank you. And Mohsin Hamid, it would be really nice to have another reading now from The Reluctant Fundamentalist. And this is a passage from very near the end, and Changezi is walking the American back to his hotel, or perhaps it might be better to say he's insisted on walking the American back to his hotel.
You, sir, on the other hand, seem ready to bolt. What has so startled you? Was it that sound in the distance? I assure you, it was not the report of a pistol, although I can understand why you might think so, but rather the misfiring exhaust of a passing rickshaw. Their two-stroke motors, often not in the best of maintenance, are prone to sputtering in that fashion. It is most disturbing, I agree. What? Is somebody following us? I cannot see anyone. No, wait. Now that you mention it, there are a few figures there, in the gloom. Well, we cannot expect to have Mall Road to ourselves, even at this late hour. In all likelihood, they are merely workers making their way home. Yes, you are right. They have paused. What do you mean, sir? Did I give them a signal? Of course not. I have as little insight into their motivations and identities as you do. One can only speculate that they have dropped something, or are engaged in conversation among themselves. Or perhaps they are wondering why we have paused, and whether we mean them ill. Regardless, there is no need for us to concern ourselves over much. Let us continue with our midnight stroll. Lahore is a city of 8 million people, after all. It is hardly a rural forest inhabited by phantoms.
Mohsin Hamid, thank you. Well, now, the end of The Reluctant Fundamentalist, which I'm not going to describe, but I mean, I just think it is stunning, absolutely stunning. But it has to be said, ambiguous. I mean, it's more than ambiguous. And we had, you will be unsurprised to hear, a mass of emails from people saying things like this. I mean, this one comes from Lizanne Baldwin in the UK, whose reading group has been discussing The Reluctant Fundamentalist. And she says, you know, we read this to our book club, everybody loved it, but we each had a different idea of what the ending was really about. And there's a Dutch listener to the BBC World Service who lives in Singapore, Elke Winberg, who writes, to what extent are we as readers meant to find our own interpretation of your novel's ending?
I think as readers, you are meant to find your own interpretation of the novel's ending, because the novel, well, it ends, but it ends, you know, shortly before it feels like it should end. And it gives the first beat of two beats, and that second beat, which you're impelled towards, really what it sounds like is up to you. But the novel isn't ambiguous for the sake of being ambiguous. It's ambiguous, and the ending is ambiguous, for the sake of allowing a relationship to do what it needs to do, or to be what it is. The way I write novels is, or the way I wrote this novel anyway, is not I am saying, here is a story, listen to it. The way I viewed it is, I'm constructing something which, when you as a reader bring your own imagination and time and attention and emotion to, becomes something. And together, we are going to create something. And the story that you read will be subtly different from the story anybody else reads because of how you feel about it. And the ending is part of that. It also has to do with what I think novels do. I think that among the different storytelling forms in a film, you see a much more fully realized version of a story because the characters have been, you know, they're actual people that you see on screen. You can hear their voices. There's a soundtrack that suggests emotion. All sorts of things are going on. When you read a novel, what you are doing is you're actually seeing black characters on a white page. And that becomes people and emotions and things. And it requires, I think, a greater creative engagement on the part of the reader. You know, you are creating the novel when you read it. And so the notion of a novel that leaves certain things for you to create differently from how other people create them and gives an ending which leaves you as creator of meaning is one that I'm inclined towards. And also, I think, by encouraging the reader to be a part writer of the story, it also hopefully leaves the reader with a notion of what kind of story have they, the reader, written. And that's an important part of this, because I think so much of media and, you know, mass communication now is trying to tell us what we should feel. That one thing I think which novels can perhaps usefully do is allow us to ask, what do we actually feel? And in fact, force us to ask that.
Yes, the gentleman there.
Thank you. Sorry, my name is Peter. I'm from Wilson. I'm from the same country as the man from Hamburg, who is Irish. I have to say that in relation to something you said earlier around hate and love, I wholly loved your book. I am entirely furious with you. I am delighted that I'm here. I'm furious because of the ending, in that you said it took 7 years to write this book, and I worked out that was approximately 4 lines per day over 7 years. And surely to goodness, you could have worked out, did the American shoot him outside the hotel? Someone must have killed someone.
Yes.
You have left it to us to work it out. And in terms of Shakespeare, even Enid Blyton, everyone, they all tell us at the end who the bad guy is, and you haven't told us. I just want to know, now, confidentially here, because we promised to tell no one, who did the butler do it?
You know, if I had decided an ending after the book, it would have been very difficult for me to write the book, you know, without clearly biasing it towards that ending. So I left it ambiguous on purpose. But also, I think the reason why it maybe feels a bit more ambiguous than is comfortable is because there is another character in this story, which is the reader, which is you. And, you know, you are reacting to this novel as you read it. And in a way, the story is not just about Cengiz and the American and Erica, but it's about how you are reacting to your world and how you're reacting to this book. And so the ending is partly about that character, you know, you, the reader. If, let's say, at the end of the novel, you know, surely someone kills someone is sort of how you expressed it, then I would say this is a novel in which there is actually no incident of violence perpetrated by any of the main characters. No one in the book has, as of yet, demonstrated that they have the capacity to kill anyone else. Two people very often will meet in a bazaar in different parts of the world and talk and go away without killing each other. Why is it so easy, then, to construct a feeling that someone must be up to killing somebody else when we have no real reason for believing it's the case? And I would suggest that because we've all been programmed to feel that that is how the world works, although the reasons for feeling that and the balance of probabilities in feeling that don't really add up.
Well, listen, you're sitting there looking so innocent as though butter wouldn't melt in your mouth. There are reasons why people think somebody might
get killed.
Yes. I mean, there's a point when Cengiz says something like, you know, you have a bulge under your armpit, sir. I mean, that is probably just your wallet and you're hiding it there so it won't get stolen.
Yep.
Of course, it is also where people hide their guns. I mean, I'm paraphrasing a good deal less elegantly than you write it. You are moving us from position to position as well, aren't you?
I am indeed. And I think all I can say is, weapons of mass destruction. It is very easy to construct a story based on hints and suggestion and take us to all sorts of, desperate consequences in the absence of real verifiable fact. And so the novel, in a way, is a kind of, I guess, sexed-up dossier that, you know, whether there are weapons of mass destruction in this book or not, who knows? But certainly there is not enough information for us to conclude one way or the other that there are. And I think that rather than being about which of these two characters should be frightened of the other at the end of the book, for me, the book is about the fear that we all already feel and the fact that it goes unexamined so easily.
I have one final question for you, Mohsin Hamid. It comes from someone who was herself a guest on the BBC World Book Club a couple of months ago. She taught you writing when you were yourself at Princeton, and she's the American novelist and Nobel laureate Toni Morrison. And when I said that you were coming on the programme in a couple of months' time, she said, I've got a question for him. OK? This is her question. Mohsin, how did you enjoy my classes?
Did she really ask that question?
Yeah, she seriously did.
You know, her classes were unbelievable. I don't know if I would be a novelist now if I hadn't taken a class with Toni Morrison and with Joyce Carol Oates, my other great teacher as an undergraduate. You know, I talked a little bit about the romantic quest, you know, the notion that when you're 22 years old, a young man, there's this irrational pull to slay dragons. Well, I was 21 when I was in Toni Morrison's class, and I wrote the first draft of what would become my first novel, Mordsmoke, in that class. We were invited to write a piece of long fiction. I wrote the entire draft of a novel in 3 months. And I still have her handwritten notes. And aside from what she taught me, because she did teach me actually a great deal, but aside from what she taught me, the romance of that experience, of being a young writer, 21 years old, sitting in the class of somebody of that stature, was part of my dragon-slaying quest, I guess.
Well, that is all the questions we've got time for. I should declare an interest that maybe I should have declared at the beginning of the programme, which is to say that, for me, The Reluctant Fundamentalist was the best book of 2007.
Thank you.
Next month, our special guest will be the Australian author Kate Grenville, talking about The Secret River, which was not published in 2007, all right? It's her prize-winning novel of the deadly clash in the early 19th century between transported British convicts and Aboriginal Australians. Do join me for that. For now, from me, Harriet Gilbert, and producer Karen Holden, thank you to all you members of the BBC World Book Club, whether listening at home or here at Bush House. And thanks especially to this month's guest, Mohsin Hamid. Here.